World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
Two American armies are on the attack today. First Army forces are threatening the German city of Aachen with encirclement. And the front dispatch reports that General Patton's Third Army has moved 6 miles forward between Metz and Nancy. The Free Yugoslav Radio says Russian and Yugoslav forces have begun the final attack on Belgrade. In Greece, British troops are nearing the outskirts of Corinth. In Italy, Americans are 12 miles from Bologna. And early this morning, Wendell Willkie died in a New York hospital. Those are the principal developments. And now for details of the news from the Western Front, Admiral takes you to Belgium. Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
The American First Army's trap is to melt clothing behind the city of Aachen. North and east of it, our infantry is pushing together. The attack began this morning at 4 o'clock when one famous infantry division started pushing northward. In the first hours of the attack, they took the town of Berladenheide against only moderate opposition. A few hours later, more infantry started pushing down from Arnsdorf to meet them, brushing aside a German counterattack of tanks and self-propelled guns. German prisoners of war said that they'd been ordered at all costs to keep the points of our fences from closing behind the city. Late this afternoon, when I left the front, our two points were only about 4 miles apart. And Crucifix Hill is in our hands. This is a 1,000-foot hill marked by a white stone cross from which German observation posts have been calling artillery fire down on our position for the last 3 weeks. From it, we now can bring our own observed shellfire onto the last two roads of escape leading out of Aachen. Inside the city, there's no sign of life. There are only comparatively few troops in it, and out of a peacetime population of 160,000, we don't think there are more than about 10,000 hiding in cellars. I've looked into the city from one of our forward observation posts. It's very badly damaged, and its main value to us will be the network of good roads that fan out from it. There's no sign the Germans will make any desperate attempts to hold on. As a matter of fact, they may very well try to pull out tonight while they still have a chance and fall back behind the next natural line of defense, the Ruhr River, 8 miles to the east. That's back behind the Siegfried Line, but civilian conscripts have been digging anti-tank ditches behind it and dugouts for tanks. We expect that our infantry points will meet behind Aachen very soon. When they do, we'll have a breach in the Siegfried Line 23 miles long, a jumping-off point that'll give General Hodges a free hand. This is Richard C. Hotelet with the American First Army in Belgium, returning you now to Admiral in New York.
And for supplementary information, Admiral takes you now to London, Larry Lesser reporting.
With the piercing of the Siegfried Line defenses north of Aachen, accomplished by the American First Army, a new attack has been started further south. This time by General Patton's Third Army. The Third Army offensive began at dawn this morning on the 20-mile front between the French fortress cities of Metz and Nancy, where the Germans hold a shallow salient, but a well-defended one. The Third Army doughboys jumped up through a smokescreen after the German positions had been heavily bombarded. And latest reports say we've cleared at least 8 towns and control important hills after denting the German defenses for a gain of 6 miles. Up in western Holland, the 1st Canadian Army is fighting bitterly in their bridgehead across the Leopold Canal. This stiffly contested bridgehead still consists of 2 Canadian pockets not yet linked up. Powerful German artillery and mortar fire has delayed the building of a bridge across the canal. These German troops, cornered on the shores of the Scheldt estuary, are good troops, and they're fighting back well. Clearing up this pocket will not be a walkover. Further east, the Canadian advance northward from Antwerp is going more quickly. The Canadians there are on the point of cutting the German escape route from the Scheldt Islands off the Dutch coast. The causeway leading to the Dutch mainland is already under Canadian artillery fire. Once this is cut, the Germans in the half-flooded island of Walcheren and the Scheldt pocket will have little chance of escaping. And things were made worse for them today by yesterday's RAF raid, which smashed the dike east of Flushing and poured another deluge of seawater across Walcheren Island. To the far south of the front, the Germans have been counterattacking heavily against the American 7th Army east of Epinal. The Germans are also hanging on just north of the Belfort Gap. That is, at the town of Lutilo, a big road center with direct communications to the famous Belfort Gap and the lower Rhine Valley. Yesterday, the Germans tried to head off the Americans encircling the town, but were beaten off. This is tough fighting country with deep valleys and very heavily wooded hillsides of the Vosges Mountain foothills.
That was Larry Lesser in London. More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
There'll be a lot of new products in the market after the war, and there'll be a lot of miraculous claims made of the wonders they'll perform. One important point to keep in mind when you see the Admiral 2-temperature refrigerator is the fact that here is a product long past the experimental stage. For 6 years before the war, this remarkable refrigerator was available to many highly satisfied owners. Their high praise and endorsement of its many exclusive features are very convincing. Hundreds of testimonials could be presented as to its convenience, economy, and health-preserving qualities. One of the most popular features of the Admiral 2-temperature refrigerator is that there is no regular, distasteful job of defrosting. In the Admiral, there are no space-stealing coils to defrost, and you can easily see how much more room for food this provides. Other owners are most enthusiastic about Sterilamp, with ultraviolet ray action for killing bacteria. And every pre-war owner is proud of the built-in home freezer for fast freezing and storing foods at home. Yes, the complete 2-temperature refrigerator will be Admiral engineered and built by the same great organization that has made Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
And for a summary of the latest developments in Italy and the Peloponnesus, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
This is the critical season on the Italian front. The first snows have fallen in the mountains, the rains continue. In the past week, the Americans have edged 5 miles closer to Bologna. They have 13 miles to go. The next 2 or 3 weeks may decide whether our armies here will join in the general assault on Germany's own frontiers or will spend another winter fighting on Italian soil. Here in Rome, Allied economic chiefs are worried about the coming months in Italy, about the 22 million Italians in the north whom we may have to feed this winter. The first reaction here to President Roosevelt's statement on increased aid to Italy came from the acting chief of the Allied Control Commission's economic section, Anthony Antonini. The president announced that 150,000 tons of wheat and flour were scheduled for shipment here. Regardless of that shipment, Mr. Antonini says, the Allied Control Commission would have to face the grave question of reducing the bread ration scale in Italy if our armies on moving north find that the Germans have largely destroyed or taken away the grain harvest of the Po Valley. The president's statement did not say when the grain shipments for Italy should arrive. According to Mr. Antolini, basic food requirements demand the importation of 100,000 tons of grain monthly. Allied economic chiefs believe we should be able to get through the winter if the front remains where it is. But if the imports do not come, and if on moving north we find extensive tillage and flooding in the Po Valley, a general bread ration cut may be necessary. Advancing into northern Italy, the Allies will face imponderables of a very serious nature. How much of Italy's harvest remains? How much of Italy's industry have the Germans destroyed or dismantled? How many hundreds of thousands of unemployed will there be in the industrial north, the nerve center of the country, where people are quicker to react, politically more awake and aroused? We know that German experts are going through the Italian industry with a fine-tooth comb, stripping it of all they can use in Germany, scientifically wrecking the rest. All our reports indicate that we will find in northern Italy social chaos without parallel, even in this idle, hungry, and war-ravaged country.
Winston Burdett has reported from Rome. Now for details of the vast Russian campaigns in the East, Admiral takes you to CBS Moscow, Lee White of the Chicago Daily News Foreign Service, reporting.
In Hungary, the Soviet offensive is progressing steadily, according to reports from Russian correspondents. German-Hungarian resistance is pretty stiff, but not as stiff as it might have been. The consensus is that the Hungarians, for all their vaunted love of battle, have not been fighting with any great enthusiasm. The Csendőrség, the Hungarian gendarmerie, has been ordered to guard the rear and to shoot any soldiers who retreat. As for the Germans in Hungary, Soviet correspondents comment on the large proportion of older men among the prisoners, and the surprising number of them who wear glasses. The new word for such German troops in the Soviet press is super total soldiers. People have been thrown into the lines after the completion of Dr. Goebbels' so-called total mobilization. A good idea of what the war has meant to the devastated farmlands of the Soviet Union was contained in a letter made public today addressed to Marshal Stalin from the agricultural workers of the Kiev region in the Ukraine. The letter states that more than half the tractors in this area were destroyed or stolen by the Germans. Scores of thousands of people are dead, and other scores of thousands of men are still fighting at the front. All but 8% of the oxen in this area have disappeared, and only 39% of the horses remain. The result is that instead of using tractors or even horses for plowing and harrowing this year, many collective farms in the Kiev area had to use their milk cows for the purpose. The scarcity of men is such that most of the farm work is now being done by women, and the scarcity of even cows is such that large tracts of land have had to be worked by woman power exclusively. There are still some tractors left, of course, but 90% of them are now being operated by women. Formerly, most tractor drivers were men. When the wheat was harvested last month, there was so little machinery available that 70% of it had to be cut by hand with scythes, and the people who wielded the scythes were also women. In spite of the devastation of this part of the Ukraine, however, the collective farms have already embarked on an ambitious program of reconstruction. Next to tractors and other agricultural machinery, the project of the highest priority is housing. Building materials are scarce in this earthy region where there's little stone or clay. And so a plan is being devised to produce lightweight building blocks from the pulp left over after the juice has been extracted from sugar beets. I return you now to New York.
And now for a summary of the European news reaching Spain, Admiral takes you to CBS Madrid, Glenn Stadler reporting.
Aspirin, the remedy for headaches, is itself causing a temporary headache here in Spain as the first cold blasts of approaching winter sweep off the snow-capped mountains, lowering the temperature to freezing, even down in usually balmy Seville. Because very limited supplies now come from Germany, and only by plane, stocks of pure aspirin are practically exhausted. Druggists already have dug deeply into the ton-and-a-half reserve. Word got around of the shortage, and many of Spain's 20 million regular aspirin users made runs on pharmacies. The stores, unable to get stocks from the state-authorized distributing agencies, had to ration pills to one small tube per customer. Spain, like most of the other countries in Europe, had depended almost entirely on shipments from Germany, which was Europe's biggest aspirin producer. Heretofore, Spain had received the powder from Germany and pressed and bottled the tablets here. Now, Lufthansa planes bring only small amounts, with freight cost up 150% since the liberation of France eliminated Germany's land communications with the Iberian Peninsula. This fact has left big German chemical interests here literally holding an empty bag. In the past few days, five German chemists who had been supervising the preparation of the drugs have been relieved of their jobs, and unless they can get permission to work for local companies, are liable for recalling to Berlin for Hitler's total mobilization. Although seriously dislocating the market for the time being, this freedom from dependence on imports may prove to be a favor to Spanish chemical producers who already make several products similar to aspirin. Mass production has not been necessary until now because the German products were cheaper and better. Spain has the ingredients for aspirin, and manufacturers are making plans to step up production to supply this country's entire needs. Druggists here say that there was no need for general alarm over the temporary shortage of certain brands because, barring unforeseen events, there are sufficient similar drugs to care for a normal demand. They estimated that Spaniards take about 8,000 pounds of aspirin yearly, an average of 40 pills or less than one a week. And each tablet costs the equivalent of 2 American cents, each one. This is Glenn Stadler in Madrid, returning you to Admiral in New York.
In the Pacific War, our planes are still hammering at Jap bases from the Kurils in the north to the southern Philippines. Southwest Pacific bombers struck at Zamboanga in the southwestern Philippines, and they also bombed airfields, docks, and shipping in waters west of Dutch New Guinea. In the Kurils, says Admiral Nimitz, our bombers sank a cargo ship. In the Palau Islands, our tanks and artillery have made new progress against the Japs in the caves of Bloody Nose Ridge, but it's still a slow and very difficult job. Admiral Nimitz reports that so far over 12,000 Japs have been killed in the Palau campaign. We have captured 224. And now for a discussion of the Russian situation, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
Both on the north and the south, the developments on the Russian front are of considerable military importance. The Russians have now gained possession of the greater part of the Estonian island of Oesel, or Saaremaa, which when completed will give the Russian fleet full access to the Baltic Sea. South of Riga, the Russians are driving westward for the Baltic shore. This operation will, if fully successful, not only transfer the ports of Libau and Vindau from German to Russian possession, thus bringing the Russian naval influence well down the Baltic and pushing the German naval power back to Königsberg. But what is probably more important, it will bring the Russian armies up to the Niemen River, the northeastern frontier of East Prussia, and will therefore expose that German province to attack on three sides. Probably the most important Russian gains, however, are in Hungary and Yugoslavia. Very strong Russian forces are advancing northwestward into the Hungarian plain, driving toward the capital, Budapest. At last report, the Russians are only 83 miles from that city, with German and Hungarian resistance apparently growing weaker all along the front. The Hungarian army has only 8 good divisions, built up on the framework of divisions which fought alongside the Germans in Russia. There are perhaps 8 additional divisions which have been recently raised and are deficient in training and equipment. For the most part, the Hungarian army has old Czechoslovak tanks and guns captured by the Germans in 1939 and transferred to the Hungarians. These are now obsolete and spare parts for them are difficult to get. This may in part account for the weakening of the Hungarian resistance. In Yugoslavia, the Russians have joined Marshal Tito's forces in the siege of Belgrade, and another Russian column is driving north toward Hungary. Still a third Russian force coming through Hungary has established 2 bridgeheads across the Danube, according to a German radio report picked up by Columbia's shortwave listening station, but not yet confirmed from any Allied source. If Belgrade falls, the main escape route for the German troops in Greece and southern Yugoslavia will have been cut. This will be a hard blow to the Germans, for every trained German soldier is now desperately needed for the defense of the Reich itself. But even harder will be the blow if Budapest is taken, for this will threaten the opening of a new southern front which the Germans will be hard driven to defend. The Hungarian plain leads the Russian armies northward toward the Moravian gateway between the Bohemian hills and the Carpathian mountains, the historic opening into Germany from the south. It may prove that the roundabout route through Budapest is, after all, one of the shortcuts to Berlin. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
A Marine combat correspondent from Los Angeles has just returned from the Battle of Peleliu. For his story, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
I'd like to have you meet one of the first 2 Marines to come back to the United States from Peleliu, where the 1st Marine Division has been fighting one of the bloodiest battles of the war for the last 23 days. He's Sergeant Alvin G. Flanagan of Los Angeles. Al hit the beach at Peleliu on D-Day just 40 minutes after H hour. He went in on an Amtrak with a microphone and a film recorder. He stayed there for 12 days, fighting and recording his impressions of the battle as he went along. But he's here in person now, so Al, tell us what it was like, will you?
To put it mildly, it was a surprise to most of us. The island is only 2 by 5 miles, and for several days the Navy had blasted it with big guns, aerial rockets and bombs and everything in the book. And just before H hour, the island looked as though Tojo's fireworks factory had received a direct hit, and then we started in. And even up to that time, we thought it was going to be a cinch. The first 2 or 3 waves made it. But by that time, the Japs had climbed out of their coral dugouts and set up their mortars. And from then on, for the next week, anything that approached the beach was a mortar target. And the Japs are artists with mortars.
Well, did you do any recording on the way in?
Oh, yes, I started in very blithely, just as if I were back here broadcasting a football game.
Incidentally, Al, was a veteran radio man in the States before he joined the Marines 2 years ago.
But I wasn't nonchalant very long about it.
What happened?
About 1,000 yards offshore, when we started through the reef, Jap mortars began dropping all around. Big 8-inch ones. The largest ones we'd ever seen. Just off the beach, a Jap pillbox in a jungle thicket opened up on us with a machine gun and hit 5 of our men. Lieutenant Colonel Walt sent in a demolition outfit to knock it out. While they circled around to attack from the beach side, Private First Class Fink of Cherry Tree, Pennsylvania, and I went into the thicket about 25 yards from the beach. I was sitting there with a mic recording the work of the demolition crew when the Jap ran out of the pillbox on our side, right in front of us. He was about 10 or 15 feet away with a machine gun cradled in his arms, pointed straight at us. Fink yelled and we both fired. The Jap was about a second too late.
Well, I'm glad of that.
And so am I.
Al, in an operation like that, what are the biggest obstacles you have to overcome?
Aside from the Japs, water was the chief problem. For the first 2 days, we had to dig for it. And because of the mortar fire, food was hard to get ashore. I had a chocolate bar and a can of cheese in 2.5 days. And some of the guys in the front lines didn't have that much. But beyond those obvious things, one of the worst obstacles is always scuttlebutt.
Well, how's that?
Well, rumors fly as fast and as thick as bullets. And you're worked up to such a pitch that you'll believe anything. D-Day plus 2, some of us were pinned down in a shell hole in the middle of the airstrip by sniper and mortar fire. In the midst of all that, a voice came in on my walkie-talkie, identified himself with the right code word, and told me that Germany had surrendered and that MacArthur had invaded the Philippines. We all believed that for about 2 days, and everybody had visions of going home pretty soon. You can imagine what effect that had on most of us.
By the way, Al, if this wasn't Al's first invasion, you were on New Britain, weren't you?
Yes, I was, but not in the original landings, however. By the time I got there, we only had Jap bombers to worry about. But a lot of the guys in the 1st Division have been through everything out there since the original invasion of Guadalcanal. Some of them have been there for 28 or 30 months, and you'll never find a better bunch of guys to do foxhole time with anywhere.
Well, I hope pretty soon you can spend time with them here at home. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
The death of Wendell Willkie in New York this morning brought this comment from President Roosevelt. The nation will long remember Wendell Willkie as a forthright American. Earnest, honest, whole-souled, he also had tremendous courage. This courage, which was his dominating trait, prompted him more than once to stand alone and to challenge the wisdom of counsels taken by powerful interests within his own party. In this hour of grave crisis, the country loses a great citizen through his untimely death. Governor Dewey, the Republican presidential nominee, described Willkie as one of the great men of our time. Dewey said, "His death will be mourned throughout the world. A forceful and courageous man, he made a notable contribution to the political and philosophical discussions of these critical times. His passing is a loss not only to the Republican Party, but to all of us Americans of both parties who shared his faith for a world peace." And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral.
I'll bet a lot of your friends collect their favorite music on recordings, don't they? Perhaps you're going to collect them, too, after the war, when radio phonographs will again be available. Yes, it's a great thrill for music lovers to select just the program they want and hear it perfectly played with lifelike reproduction on an Admiral radio phonograph, for example. The post-war Admiral radio phonographs will have an automatic record changer so revolutionary in design and operation that it will set a new high in musical enjoyment. As you probably know, Admiral Corporation is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. From this vast experience in engineering and production, plus continuous research, has come many new ideas for your better appreciation of your recorded favorites. Being leaders in radio, radar, communications equipment, television, and FM, Admiral will offer some brand new ideas in radio, too. So if you want a radio phonograph with the best of everything, you'll want an Admiral. The nation's paper shortage grows more acute every day. Each of us can help overcome this shortage by conserving every ounce of paper possible and by salvaging every kind of waste paper. Paper is essential to our war effort in the protection of food and equipment going to our fighting men. Let's all save all the paper we can. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney speaking coast to coast for Admiral Corporation. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago 11.